Skokie, Illinois is to Chicago very much what Mayfield Heights or Parma is to are to Cleveland. It's a white, middle class, heavily ethnic, close-in suburb, which was settled in the years immediately following the Second World War. And it's filled with people who work in factories, usually in supervisory capacities, who work in city and state government, who are accountants in large corporations, shopkeepers, and the like. The difference between Mayfield Heights, Parma, and Skokie is that the village of Skokie, which numbers some 70,000, is more than 50% Jewish. And of that, about 45,000 souls who are Jewish, perhaps 5,000 to 7,000 are those who survived Nazi Europe. In February of last year, the American National Socialist Party, the Chicago branch, the Nazis, announced that they were going to parade through Skokie on Hitler's birthday, the 20th of April. The village responded by denying to the Nazis a permit to parade. The Nazis had spoken of a parade which would involve between 30 and 50 individuals, their total membership, by the way, in Chicago, carrying signs espousing white power, claiming that the white voice in America was being suppressed, but wearing, and this was of course the critical issue, wearing stormtrooper uniforms, wearing the swastika armband and goose-stepping their way through this village, over half of whose citizens are Jews. Now the Nazis of Chicago do not live in Skokie. Their center is a little community in South Chicago near Marquette Park, where they have a small hall called the George Lincoln Rockwell Hall, named after their late unlamented leader, Fuhrer. Part of Chicago they live in is very much like some of those areas along St. Clair near East 30th Street. Little enclaves of whites who have been left behind by the movement of whites out of the center city and who are completely surrounded by Huff, Norwood, by large areas of black settlement. The Nazis, such as they are, live in the residue, what's been left behind in the white community of the frightened, often racist white communities of lower middle class people in the cities. Now the Nazis were coming to Skokie not simply to have a chance publicly to speak their filth. They do that daily and weekly in their hall in South Chicago. They were going to Skokie to gain visibility, to perform a deliberately provocative act, to attract the news coverage and the television cameras. For like any small extremist group, right or left, in Arte, they recognize that they are insignificant, anonymous, that their only chance to gain disciples, converts, contributions, is to attract the press, the little red eye of the television camera. And so the fanatics of our age have discovered the colorful ways, the confrontational ways, to draw attention to themselves, attention which obviously is far greater than their number or the threat to public safety which they represent. When they were denied a permit to parade by the village government of Skokie, the American Nazis turned to the American Civil Liberties Union and cried out, our civil rights have been denied us the right of free speech and a free assembly. And the Civil Liberties Union of Chicago brought their case as a First Amendment case before the Circuit Court of Cook County, which summarily dismissed the submission. And then the Civil Liberties Union brought it to another judge of the same court who also summarily dismissed their submission. And they brought it up to an appellate court of the state of Illinois, and finally, not gaining their ends in that court, brought the case in June of last year before the United States Supreme Court. Now, the American Civil Liberties Union, as you know, is a 20th century group which has been devoted to safeguarding and protecting, as they see it, the rights of free speech and free assembly and free petition, as these are guaranteed to all Americans under the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press or the right of the people peaceably to assemble and to petition the government for a redress of grievances. The American Civil Liberties Union has a long record of defending individuals and popular causes which have been muzzled, denied their rights by various authorities, courts, governments, sheriffs across the country. But in this case, there was a great deal of concern even within the membership of the American Civil Liberties Union as to the action of their group. There was something fundamentally unseemly about a group of Jewish lawyers financed by a membership which is heavily Jewish, protecting in the courts the right of a group of people to walk into a Jewish area to tell that people by act and by word that it's too bad that Hitler didn't finish the job. And as you know from reading the press, about 1 in 8 of the membership of the American Civil Liberties Union in Illinois resigned from that body. The Jewish lawyer who is executive director of the American Civil Liberties Union, Andre Neier, in his various interviews said essentially this. This is his quote. "We do not share their values, that is the Nazi values. We do not take guidance from them. We defend free speech for Nazis or anyone else because we say that the government may not put any class or group beyond the pale of constitutional protection." It's a difficult problem. But the American Civil Liberties Union was determined to go ahead and continues to be involved directly in this issue. In June, late June of 1977, in a 5-4 decision, the United States Supreme Court ruled or remanded the case to its original court, saying that the issues must be judged on their merit. The court could not summarily dismiss the petition, and that the court had to review whether or not the village of Skokie had a set of constitutionally acceptable rules and regulations under which this parade permit might be denied the Nazis. During this litigation, the village of Skokie drew together a series of restrictions governing the certification of parade permits. It became illegal for the city to give a permit to any group which intended to march through the area in some military uniform, the uniform of a group whose symbols and attitudes were deemed repugnant to a majority of those who lived in the village. According to these rules and norms, the city government was not to issue a permit to any group which proposed to disseminate literature which was designed to incite racial or religious violence. And finally, it was a rule that the village could not issue a parade permit until those who were sponsoring the parade had posted a bond for $350,000 to guarantee the village against the costs to their security force or to property attendant to the actual parade, the day, the incident itself. Now, by the time that the United States Supreme Court remanded the case to the lower courts, the Nazis had, in fact, gained a major victory, for they had gained the attention of the press, of the media. During the spring and early summer of 1977, literally a page after page of the newsprint was devoted to the American Nazis in Chicago. There were long interviews with a man named Frank Collins, who is a 25, 26-year-old petty Führer of this group of hooligans. He was pictured in Nazi uniform, you know, Sieg Heiling in front of a picture of Adolf Hitler. It's kind of issue which our press at this point in time delights in. It's colorful. Bizarre. It deals in symbols which mean a great deal, varied but sharp things to a variety of Americans. After all of America was involved in a world war against the Nazis. There are human interest stories to be had, and no reporter requires any particular perspicacity or background or language skill or economic skill in order to cover this kind of story. And so the television cameras, the local press, the national press covered this incident in depth. I happened to go through this week the New York Times for the first 2 weeks of, for the last week of June and the first week of July of 1977. And that august newspaper, which prints only all the news that's fit to print, devoted over 3 whole pages in sum to the American Nazi Party, to this man Frank Collins, to the confrontation in Skokie. The Nazis were seen, were noted, were discussed. And more than this, the press, to be even-handed, kept going into Skokie and finding there one or another citizen who had come out of Dachau or Auschwitz, interviewing them. There was a good sob story, a human interest story. And ultimately you could find a quote which you could use as your lead. I'm not a violent man, I despise violence, but I will not have anybody bearing the swastika in my backyard. Skokie is my backyard. You had all of the anger, all of the frustration, all of the bitterness, all of the repressed traumatic memories coming to the fore. Any number of these interviews were had, published, and the whole Nazi trauma, in a sense, was relived. And of course, when the Klieg lights are turned on, when there is a headline to be won, all kinds of animals appear out of the slime. Not only the Nazis, but our own hooligans. No sooner did the issue of Skokie become one of national import than Meir Kahane, the head of the Jewish Defense League, appeared on the scene and began to utter his own variety of threats. There will be violence if the Nazis come to Skokie. Police or no police, there'll be no Nazi parade in Skokie. There will be our squads, we'll be on the street, we'll beat their heads in, we'll take blood for blood, eye for eye. The Nazis will not have their way. Now, some 10 years ago, when Meir Kahane and the Jewish Defense League first appeared on the scene, I confess that I had some respect for what they were trying to do. The late 1960s were a time in which the Jewish establishment was trying very hard to involve itself in all of those causes which made for the greater good of America. The end of racism, civil rights, the end of the war in Vietnam. We were aligned with all that was good about the future of America, but somehow we forgot that in the process of moving into the future, there were elderly Jews and poor Jews who were being left behind in the center cities, and that we were not doing what every other group was involved in protecting our own, and seeing to it that our poor, our weak, our elderly would not alone or be part of the group that would have to bear the brunt of change. And so when the Jews, the elderly Jews of New York, complained to the various defense agencies that election to the poverty boards had been geared to be held on the Sabbath, where they couldn't come and couldn't vote, and therefore they were being denied their place and control of their own destiny, no one paid much attention to them. And when the Jewish school teachers of New York complained that whatever the merits or demerits of local school district control, it meant effectively that they were being done out of their jobs and were losing their, not only their seniority, but their rights to a livelihood, no one paid much attention to them. And when those who lived in some of the less advantaged areas of Brooklyn, the Bronx, complained that their streets were unsafe, they had no friend at City Hall to demand, you know, greater police protection for them. And it was in those years that Meir Kahan and the Jewish Defense League first emerged as a reminder that to the Jewish establishment that one of the major responsibilities of Jewish life must be the protection of one's own. And they said that if there is no safety, we will, in a sense, see that safety is established. But as the months passed into the years, this group, which served at the beginning, I think, a useful purpose, became more and more convinced in the value of violence for violence's sake. I remember reading someplace where Kahan said, I'm going to create a group called Chaya, which in Hebrew means beasts. And we're going to have our own beasts who are going to be able to show to the world, to the anti-Semites, that they have reason to be afraid. And within a year or two, you'll remember that the Jewish Defense League began threatening to kidnap Soviet ministers and their families in order to force the Soviet to free Jews. In one instance, at least, members of the Jewish Defense League shot into the apartment of a family of Soviet ministers who were accredited to the United Nations. Meir Kahan went to Israel, where he was arraigned and convicted for trying to smuggle Israeli arms into the United States for his beasts. He was deported from Israel for having sent through his group a set of threatening letters to Arab Israeli citizens telling them that they had better leave Israel if they knew what was good for them. His group had gone down to Dimona, where there are a group of blacks who have settled there claiming that the Holy Land is theirs, and his group has several times, you know, engaged in violent fisticuffs and battles with this group. He has become, with his Jewish Defense League at this point in time, a goon squad, a group of people who can be brought in when muscle is needed, or he comes more often unbidden. And his message is never again a simplistic message. It's a message which begins in that confusion most of us have. Would the Jews have been better off, would more have survived, if in fact more had taken arms against the Nazis or even beat at the Nazis with their fists, tried to do something? Wasn't the passivity of the Jew somehow a stimulant to the anger, to the bestiality of the German, of the anti-Semite? Never again. Never again will the Jew be passive. Never again will the Jew simply take what is dished out to him. Never again will he turn the other cheek. That's Kahani's message. And in early July, on the 4th of July, on the day that the parade of the Nazis had been rescheduled but did not take place because the court case had not yet been adjudicated, Kahani came to Skokie and he held a rally on the pavement, the parking lot of the Jewish Community Center there. They told a few hundred of his followers, people who agreed with him, that he and his would see to it that the Nazis would not be able to march into Skokie. And we had there the paradoxical situation in which the American Nazis were obeying the courts, and we Jews were not. There was no parade permit for the 4th of July for a meeting in the parking lot of the Jewish Community Center. It had not been accredited by the board of the center. The center was closed that day. But there they were, parading, placarding, making sure that Kahan's speech was faithfully recorded and the placards photographed for television and for the press. Well, since that day, the case has wound its way through the courts. 2 weeks ago, it was announced in the paper that the Illinois Supreme Court had ordered the village of Skokie to grant a permit to the American Nazis. The village indicated it would appeal that decision to the United States Supreme Court, and the Nazis indicated that they planned to hold their parade just a year later, on the April 20th of 1978, on the anniversary of Hitler's birth. Now, what's our reaction to this set of circumstances? Part of our reaction, obviously, will be determined by our judgment as to the potential of danger implicit in the American Nazi Party. Those who study such matters indicate that there are, how many? Think in your own minds. 10,000, 5,000 members of the American Nazi Party. Experts indicate that they're less than 600. They're divided into small, often competing cells around the United States. There's even one cell in Los Angeles which is limited to homosexual Nazis. Some of these Nazis, a few individuals, are in contact with the larger national fronts and Nazi parties in Germany and England and elsewhere. But most of these people seem to be disturbed, troubled, angry, youngish men who come out of the lower middle class, powerless, impotent people who have somehow found that their sense of worth is actualized when they get into the uniform and they feel part of some worldwide movement. The American Nazi Party has on occasion run candidates for various local offices. School board once in Baltimore, a member of the city council in Gary, Indiana, a few other times. And no such election. And the elections were always held at a time of heightened racial tension in that particular community. When the question of school busing or something like that was on the agenda, at no time has this candidate won more than 5.5% of the vote. And when pollsters and social theoreticians have analyzed the vote and asked, why did you vote for this man or woman identified as a member of the American Nazi Party, the answer rarely had to do with their Nazism. It had almost universally to do with the fact that here was a way of protesting integration, protesting social change. It was a larger protest, not one designed particularly to complement the announced principles of the Nazi Party. What is suggested is simply this, that if fascism or anti-Semitism ever become large-scale political forces in America, and it's obviously not impossible, but if they ever do, it will not be under the aegis of or through the instrumentality of the American Nazi Party. There'll be other forms to these new institutions. American Nazism is identified with a war which America fought and won. It's identified with a force which Americans, by and large, deemed to be evil and alien. It was a simple war in which there was right on our side and evil on the other, and we're now not about to take that evil into our own homes and into our breasts. For Jews, of course, the very existence of a Nazi uniform evokes memories that most of us try desperately to repress. And when we see a Nazi uniform, we can be forgiven if judiciousness and dispassions for a while escape us. 1 in 3 Jews were murdered because of those who wore that uniform. The American Nazi Party is at this time less a subject worthy of study by political theorists and more a study worthy of those who deal in social pathology and in psychopathology. Frank Collins, who is the young Fuhrer of this Chicago group, is a man in his late 20s. He would be among the anonymous and the unseen. He's unemployed. He has very few saleable skills. He became a Nazi by watching, according to his own testimony, of all things, an Anti-Defamation League film about the Nazis. What moved him as he watched this film some 15 years ago, as a child and still before his age of puberty, was the power, the charisma that Hitler had, speaking of Nuremberg, the thousands who were responding to him. And obviously, this was a power that he craved, a response, a leadership role that he wanted for himself. And most interesting of all, this man who left home to join Rockwell, some 12 years ago, comes from a family, he's an immigrant. His mother is Roman Catholic, his father's a Jew. His father is a Jew who himself came out of the concentration camps. Family doesn't make itself available for interviews, but the grandmother in one of the articles I saw was interviewed, and from her words you can understand something of the prejudices and the sense of values and the home in which this man comes. This was the grandmother speaking, the Roman Catholic grandmother. Frank comes from a good family. He has been brought up decently and very well. It was a surprise to us when we found it was the Jews he was fighting against. We could kind of understand they're going against the colored, but not against the Jews. We even lived among them. Now, what is our reaction to this decision of the Nazis? Our reaction to the Skokies counter concerns, the activities of the American Jewish community. One of the most interesting aspects of this particular incident is that it shows that the American Jewish community has itself moved from the kind of predictable First Amendment absolutism of 10 years ago to a different position. 10 years ago, if such an incident had come to the fore, the wisdom which would have governed local federations, the National Jewish Community Relations Advisory Council, the other establishment defense agencies would have been this. It would have been a cool wisdom. This is an insignificant group. It's more important that we defend the First Amendment, free speech, free assembly, we're a minority, than when we take any legal or other action against them. Let's counsel our own Jews to cool it, not to protest. Let's use the opportunity to educate through the schools and the churches of the area. Let's try and talk to the media about not giving to this particular group undue coverage. But most of the energies of the Jewish organizations would have been devoted to telling Jews to remain quiet, that their anger was the very thing that the Nazis were counting on to create an incident. They were counting on the incident to bring in the media, the television coverage. This time around, our national agencies adopted another line. That is, they encouraged the village of Skokie and supported the legal activities of the village of Skokie, challenging in the court this absolute definition of the First Amendment. And the argument which they have offered is essentially this. The First Amendment is not an absolutist permission for any kind of speech, any kind of assembly, at any time, under any conditions. There are obviously limitations to these freedoms. One classic limitation is that if we're in a movie theater or a legitimate theater, no one in the audience can get up and suddenly shout, fire, because such a cry would endanger the lives of all who had simply come out for a happy evening of entertainment. Are there no limitations to free speech? No one is challenging the right of Rockwell or of Collins and of his few thugs to get up in the Rockwell Hall and to say whatever they want to say. But do they have the right to bring to Skokie their traveling circus and demand that they be seen in the streets of a city to whom all that they represent is anathema? There's a second issue raised. The First Amendment, the lawyers are saying, is not simply a political document. It deals with free speech that is consequential, that concerns real issues. We're dealing here, in this instance, not with a political issue, so much, they say, as with an issue of pornography, an issue of obscenity. The Nazis are not serious about trying to make a political point. They don't have the power, they don't have the ability to do so. What they're really doing is playing on the ability of their symbols to evoke an angry response from those who do not want these symbols and all that they represent, this trash, this obscenity, in their homes. And what is more obscene, really, than someone who publicly espouses genocide? What is more pornographic than one who would have us imagine again Jewish bodies stuffed and charred in the ovens? Now, when we deal with obscenity, we're dealing, as in when we deal with the First Amendment, with a very complex issue of law. And honest people will disagree honestly. But by and large, in America, we have evolved a system which allows us to say that obscenity can be published, can even be produced visually for others to see under certain conditions, but not in our homes, not where we can't avoid it. If you want to publish a pornographic magazine which has no redeeming virtues, go ahead and publish it. Put it in a cover and let it be sold under the counter to the dirty old men who want to buy such things and will come in and ask specifically for it and take it to the privacy of their rooms. And if you want to produce a pornographic movie and you have consenting adults who are willing to do so, yes, this movie has no redeeming virtues to it, it's purely obscene. But if some people need to see it and will pay to see it, let it be seen, but in movie houses which are specifically marked X, obscene. I don't have to go into them. I will never go into them by mistake. They never intrude into my life. Now, do we not have the right when it comes to this kind of obscenity that the Nazis represent? To say, there is no objection to your mouthing this obscenity among yourselves, but we have the right, we of Skokie, have the right to say you'll not come into our homes, and our village is our home. George Lincoln Rockwell Hall is marked X. Free speech, obscenity, fine. You want it, for whatever it's worth, enjoy it. But not here. Not among us. This is our home. These are our children. This is the world in which we live, and not here. Now, this argument has not yet been accepted by the courts. I don't know that it will be accepted by the courts. It's a powerful argument. It's an argument which at least suggests that civil liberties organizations like the ACLU ought to begin to make judgments. Because what has happened now is that many of these small fanatic groups, left and right, have learned that they can force the actions, the reactions of certain groups in the society who must, in a sense, defend them and finance them and protect them regardless of the filth that they spew. Discrimination is an interesting word. We use it today conventionally to mean the stereotyping of racial or caste groups. It's a gross term. It's a term that suggests what we don't like. But there's a sense in which discrimination is a virtue. Discrimination means the ability to make subtle judgments. There are times when Jews ought to stand up and return blow for blow. And there are times that Jews ought to turn their backs, and where the greater wisdom, the greater courage is to pay no attention to a few signs with which you fundamentally disagree. That's discrimination. That's judgment. The ACLU has given over its powers of discrimination to these small groups. Because willy-nilly, once they can claim that they are being denied their chance to peddle obscenity, they will be defended. I think that's unwise. I think it's possible for one to defend in our imperfect world serious civil liberties, the rights of serious speech, and say to groups such as the American Nazis, you've created your own incident, pay your own lawyers. Find your own way of solving your problem. I don't have to do it for you, and not believe that that's the civil liberties positions in the United States are being eroded. And what's true of the civil liberties area is true of our press. One of the problems that Skokie raises is the problem of the responsibility of the press discriminating between the stories which are available to them. Yes, obviously, what happened in Skokie because of the way it happened is a newsworthy story. But how newsworthy? How much space? How much attention? What kind of space? Do the Nazis qualify for a long period on a talk show in order to peddle their obscenity into every living room in the country? Why? If what they say is on the face of it obscene, why do we allow this kind of obscenity into our living rooms? We wouldn't allow other kinds of pornography to be shown in the same way. Must not the editors of the media become more discriminating as to the choice of material which they represent? They've got to know that these people who are on the fringe know how to use them and how to manipulate them. Create something that's colorful, something that's bizarre, something that's outlandish, something the camera can focus in on, an incident, and you get publicity. And that's all these people are after. Publicity. Because without publicity, they're nothing. And if they're nothing, the Nazi uniforms will quickly come off. Because that's the only reason that they're there. To make them feel as if they're somebody. Somebody of some kind, of some importance. We have to be discriminating ourselves as Jews in the response that they make, that we make. There have been endless meetings in Chicago on the issue of Skokie. Endless counsels, endless advice, endless numbers of speeches. But the discrimination has not always been there. We didn't have the ability somehow to separate out our own position, reasonable position, working it through, and the position that, the simplistic position that Meir Kahan and his group bespoke, went into the streets to establish. And there were many in the American Jewish community, people you wouldn't expect, who suddenly found themselves applauding Kahan. Because there is within us a deep sense of guilt or of frustration. The Jewish soldier somehow is coming to the fore as a major image. We haven't been discriminating about the times when we must hold our ground and stand fast, and the times when judgment suggests that patience is the higher form of courage. I don't know what's going to happen if and when the Nazis march in April or on some other date. If I were a rabbi in Skokie, I would be telling my congregation that if they march, that they should go to work that day, to school that day, and pay no attention to the march. That they should do everything in their powers, I would do everything in my power to turn my back on this group, and by my indifference to them, testify to their insignificance. because that's the very thing they can't stand, to be insignificant. I would do all that I could in my power to convince the Jewish organizations to keep, if they can, the Kahanis and his thugs out of Skokie. I would be supporting the attempts by the various Jewish groups to find a basis in law to rule such trash for what it is, filth, obscene, to deal with it on those terms. And most of all, I would commit myself to an ongoing process of discussion, of confrontation, with people with whom I have a basic, for whom I have a basic respect, those who allow me to be a citizen by providing me with information, the media, and those who are concerned with protecting my rights as an individual and as a member of a minority, groups like the American Civil Liberties Union. I think there has to be a new dialogue with both groups about discrimination, about judgment. We may not agree, but at least we'll have talked. And I think it's important for us to recognize their concerns and for them to recognize our legitimate concerns. Because if the pattern of Skokie continues to be successful for the Nazis, the one thing you can be guaranteed is that it will be repeated in community after community after community all over these United States. 2 years ago, Cleveland, Ohio, was the center of the National Conference of the American Nazi Party. How many of you knew about it? The papers didn't really cover it. They knew about it. They wanted publicity, but they didn't get publicity. And they came, they crawled into town, and they went, they crawled out of town, and we're here. And the town is secure in free speech. Secure in the town. There is a responsibility which a press must undertake to weigh what is happening in a community. Every day, hundreds of significant speeches are not reported in the press. Why must the most bizarre of all speeches be reported? Editors make judgments every day of their lives. And I think we've got to begin to discuss whether or not the Nazis don't deserve a certain kind of judgment. I don't know what the future holds for us in these United States. Depends on many things. War and peace, the state of the economy, state of the national will. I do know that a great deal of the future depends ultimately on our willingness to abide by the decisions of the courts once these are set down. And so my final position would be, and I hope this will be that of the people of Skokie, that if the courts order the parade, they allow the parade to go forth, what can the passage of 30 or 50 people through Skokie really do? And that the response that's required to this parade is not for 30 or 50 angry Jews to go down to Marquette Park and to have a counter parade. But the answer is for all of us to go about our business, being law-abiding, freedom-loving, righteousness-seeking Americans, citizens, and showing by our actions the strength in ourselves that we feel and the contempt that we feel for these hoodlums and these paranoids. Amen.